This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us in studio this evening Jeannie Soderman. We're going to be talking about water. You know, you can get by without food, but you can't get by without water. And if you could convince the people of the world that with the massive oceans we have out there, water abundant in this country, like probably no other country in the world, except maybe Canada, that we're running out of water, that there's a water shortage, and it's got to be controlled by the government. Why, you can convince them just about anything. You could probably even convince them there was global warming, that we were producing global warming. But, of course, the plan is already laid out, the World Bank water policy, and actually Jeannie has done a wonderful summary of the World Bank water policy. It's about 130, 140 pages, and she summarized it in 7 pages, which we offer. But she, of course, goes to these meetings with these people who are also concerned about water and how, of course, we're running out of water. We've got to be able to control the water, and with that, the agriculture, the industry, the people. And, of course, we certainly can't have people having wells, stealing the community water out of the earth. Oh, what a terrible thing. No, we'd rather let the water just run down the creeks and the rivers into the ocean. But, of course, we mustn't let the people use it because, of course, they're stealing it from the fishes or from something. They always have a reason, don't they, Jeannie?
Well, they always have a very good reason, Dr. Stan.
Well, you tell us, of course, what the latest things are, because I know you've been to some meetings recently with these people who want to control us by controlling the water.
Well, you know, my background is I was once a very dedicated member of Nature Conservancy, World Wildlife Fund, and Greenpeace. And for about 7 years, I was dedicated to the environmental organizations. And then I realized something was wrong, something wasn't quite right. And that's when I turned into Radio Liberty, one of your programs. And I thought, now this guy sounds a little bit off, but there's a seed of truth in what Dr. Stan is saying. So I listened to one program, and I remember you saying, well, do you listen to the evening program? I says, nope, just the afternoon program on 880 AM KFER. And so then I gradually started listening more, and I realized that there had to be some research into the environmental organizations. And I knew there were a lot of other people that were dissatisfied with the environmental organizations. But I felt committed to looking at the environmental issue. And yes, there is a summary of the World Bank water policy. It's really very concise. It's only about 7 pages. But it brings into view what the World Bank and the elitists, along with the multinational corporations, want to do. And that is specifically managing and owning the resources of the world, whether it's water, land, timber. It is total control of the resources of the world and total control of the people of the world also.
You know, it's so interesting. I was watching television this evening, the evening news, and they were talking about how the price of natural gas is going to go up. Oh, the price of gas and natural gas is going to double because there's a shortage of natural gas out there. And, well, everybody knows there's a shortage of natural gas because they keep telling us there's a shortage of natural gas. And, of course, we have a shortage because the government told all the plants that produce electricity they had to switch over to natural gas from oil or coal or whatever they were burning. And so now, of course, we can't, of course, bring the massive supplies of natural gas down from the North Slope of Alaska, where they're pumping, according to my friend Lindsay Williams, who I've had on many times, a trillion or a billion cubic feet of natural gas every day back into the earth because they can't vent it in the air. So they have to have something like 747 engines working full-time, pumping this gas, natural gas, back into the earth, where it will be stored. But anything, of course, to create the artificial shortage. So you block the drilling for oil, you block the bringing of the natural gas back here so they can double the price. And, of course, by running up the price, then they can get you to conserve. And, of course, that's what it's really all about. Going without will be lowering of your living standards, taking of your money, and, of course, gradually bringing the still living standards of the average American, or I should say raising to those of the Mexican peasant. That's what it's really all about. They're shipping our jobs overseas. They're shipping our industries overseas. They're blocking efforts to solve the energy problem so that they can, of course, use that to control us. And the same thing is true with water.
Yes. That was an amazing program you had with Lindsay Williams when he talked about every 24 hours, there is 1 billion cubic feet of natural gas pumped back into the earth. That, to me, was amazing because, as I understand, when they drill for oil, the natural gas comes up also.
Sure. Yeah.
So that was a wonderful program that you had, Dr. Stan. Yes, they are solidifying all the control of the resources of the world. And here again, water is so important. Water is essential for life, and the multinational corporations and the elitists understand that people will pay for good water. And what they have now is a term that was used at a Bureau of Reclamation meeting. It's called conjunctive use of water. And I thought, well, that's kind of a strange word. So I kind of looked it up in the dictionary. And conjunctive is like combining things together. And what they plan to do, the federal government, which is tied in with the United Nations treaties, is to combine groundwater water with surface water. In other words, everyone lives in a water basin. There's an aquifer underneath the ground. Here in Santa Cruz County in California, we have a water basin. And they want to combine the groundwater and the surface water. Well, the question arises is what's going to happen to the private property water wells? And they do have a plan to bring those private property water wells into the what they call user associations. So they want to bring the private water well owners into like a group, and it will be called a water user association.
And then I suppose they're going to put a meter on the well, and then they're going to begin to tell you, we just want to get an idea how much water you're using, how much water is there. You know, we have to have this knowledge, and then the next thing, they're going to begin to restrict the use, and then they're going to get down to the 10 gallons a day that, of course, the World Bank water policy wants. All of these things are done very gradually because they figure that people are too dumb to understand, and they simply lie to us what it's all about. But it's really all about control. It's about running up the price of water if you're in a municipal area to the point you're not going to be able to afford to use it, creating artificial shortages, blocking efforts to build the dams and the reservoirs, and all the other things that would provide ample water, both surface water and the underground water and the aquifers, because they don't want a solution. They want a problem.
Oh, yes, they've created the problem, and every place there is a problem, there is a water crisis. Here in Santa Cruz County in California, we have an abundance of water. We have about 100 inches of rain on the top of the Santa Cruz Mountains. Lower, we have maybe about 30 inches of rain, average about 2.5 feet. The water here in Santa Cruz County. So we have a lot of water. But as you say, Dr. Stan, they have not built the reservoirs.
But they keep having the studies. Oh, we're going to have another study. Oh, we're going to have another study. And then we're going to have 3 more studies. And we're going to blow millions of dollars on studies, but not 1 cent to try to solve the problem.
Well, it's the studies they call, it's feasibility studies. And this is why we're in debt. We're in debt to all the studies that are being done, the pilot projects. And that's why all the counties and all the cities are saying, well, we don't have money for the firemen. We don't have money for the police department. Why we don't have money is all the monies are going into all these studies, millions and millions of dollars. So there again, restoration projects on the rivers, and they're spending so much money on fish studies. here in Santa Cruz County, we have the coho salmon and the steelhead. And, of course, fish is much more important than human beings.
And, of course, in places all across the country, they're clubbing the salmon so that they won't have so many, so they can say there's a shortage. And we can have pictures of them out there clubbing the salmon, electrocuting the salmon to death, so they can't spawn, so there'll be shortages. This is how they do it, and the people really don't understand there is a secret agenda behind this. Certainly, we've got a shortage of fish, but you killed them. Oh, well, those were hatchery fish, you know, as if somehow hatchery fish are different than regular fish.
Well, that was an interesting video because they were actually killing both the wild native fish that they call, and also the hatchery fish. And you could see them as they went through the tube. They said, well, they were saving the wild native fish. Well, they went through the tube and down to the river. And when they got to the river, they went belly up. They were killed. And what they were killing them in is these big vats of water, and they electrified all the fish. And that was a horrendous video that we do have, and that was done undercover by a person up in Oregon, as I recall. A conjunctive use of water really stems from the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro in 1992.
Comes out of the Global Biodiversity Assessment Report?
Well, actually, it comes out of the International Agenda 21.
Okay.
And each chapter is on, say, a forestry. One is on water. And Chapter 18 of the International Agenda 21 talks about the quality and supply of fresh water. And I happened to be at a meeting at Pajaro Valley Water Management Agency here in Santa Cruz County. And one of the board directors says, Jeannie, this has nothing to do with Agenda 21. And it certainly does, because on page 182, it talks about encouraging conjunctive use of surface and ground water. So they already had it thought out of how they were going to control our water.
All right. So basically, what do they intend to do? I mean, they combine the surface water and the underground water, but then how are they going to use that to control us?
Well, they're actually going to do, here again, studies on base flow of the streams. And they have a certain amount of statistics data that the fish need a certain amount of water in order to swim through the streams down to the ocean. And so they're going to be looking at the base flow. Now, this is important because if they say the base flow of the water in the streams is too low, they're going to tell the private property well owners that you're taking too much water out of the aquifer, out of the basin, and you will have to ration your water. And this is where they'll be going after the private wells.
But of course, what does the well, you know, down 160, 250, 1,000 feet have to do with the water going down the stream?
Well,
I mean, the water doesn't come from the well up to the surface. It goes from the surface down, unless, of course, they know something I don't know.
Well, that's interesting how they say this, but really what they're doing is pseudoscience.
Right.
It's really not true science. And what they're saying is the surface water and the groundwater, it's all blended together in this water basin, in this aquifer. So any water that you take, whether it's from groundwater or surface water, it's just the same from the same pot.
It's all water, you know.
Yes.
And, of course, they look so learned. I'll never forget one time going to a meeting on air pollution. And of course, they were talking about, oh, how terrible the air quality was in our community. We had to have more regulations, and we had to put, parking meters and on all the churches and doctor's offices to get people out of their cars. And I got up and I said, you know, we have the cleanest air in the entire state. I mean, only one day out of last year did we exceed the standards, and that was, we have the cleanest air in the entire state. You want to regulate our air? And I said, you know, why don't you do something about the diesel trucks? Mm-hmm. Oh, diesel is not smog. I mean, you see that black smoke coming out of there? You're probably believing your lying eyes. Listen to us. We're the experts. Diesel smoke is not the smog, you know. And then he gives into this nitrous oxide and sulfur oxide and all these things. And of course, I don't know that much about it. But they snowed everybody in the audience, convincing everybody that certainly we had these terrible problems. And of course, anybody who was concerned about diesel smoke, the smoke coming out of diesel engines, was somehow an extremist who really didn't have any education in these higher things. And then, of course, here about 20 years later, they suddenly said, now the major pollutant is diesel smoke. And, of course, they've forgotten that for years they told us it wasn't. So these people just lie. But they're all schooled. They're educated. They have programs to teach people how to lie, to convince the suckers. Of course, we've got to be able to regulate them. We've got to be able to regulate the water because, after all, everybody knows the world is running out of water.
It's the old saying, figures don't lie but liars figure.
They sure do.
And they only tell you the information that they can say, well, these figures are correct. They don't give you the whole picture. And yes, I went on a water tour of San Joaquin Valley a couple weeks ago, and it was put on by an educational foundation for water. And there were four young people in our group that had mentors in Sacramento. So these young people were learning to be leaders in the conservation of water. And so what they're giving to these young people, they were in a college and high school, is they're giving the young people only the facts that they want them to hear. They're not giving the young people the total picture of what's happening in the water arena. This conjunctive use, combining the surface and the groundwater, usually entails importation of water. And as you know, our local Watsonville Pajaro Valley Water Management Agency wants to buy a district called the Broadview District in San Joaquin Valley. And they want to buy the water from that district. It will cost them $25 million for the water rights. And they want to import the water from San Joaquin Valley into the Watsonville farmlands.
And what's going to happen to the people in the area that where they're taking all the water from?
Well, they're going to raise rates up already from $80 an acre foot up to $120. It will go very high. What we're looking at, they say maybe $316 an acre foot.
And, of course, that is the agricultural area that is aimed, of course, at limiting agriculture because, of course, shortages of food really are better than excesses. We'll be right back here in a moment with our special guest, Jeannie Soderman, here on Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Of course, our guest in studio is Jeannie Soderman. We're talking about water. We're talking about, of course, how the people here are planning. And they have these long-range plans. They have blocked efforts to put dams and reservoirs and anything to store water in the mountains where we have plenty of room for storing water. Oh, we can't do that. Oh, we might endanger a slug or a snail or maybe a bird or a bee or a moth or something. Oh, we can't do anything to solve the problem. And, of course, just let us. We'll solve it for you. And, of course, ladies and gentlemen, you must understand there is a fascist mentality out there that believes that we need a ruling elite. And, of course, these ideas go back to the writings of Plato and to a man named Louis Strauss, who taught at the University of Chicago. And many of the people who are got their doctorates underneath him really believe we do need a ruling elite. We do need a feudalistic system. We do need to have men who are so much brighter than the rest of us running our lives. That's really what communism is all about. Communism is an elite system. It has nothing to do with redistributing the wealth. What it is redistributing your wealth to them. And, of course, in this system, the ruling elite has all the money they want and all the luxury they want and special resorts, and they're provided for. And then, of course, the people are simply oppressed, as George Orwell said, like a boot stamping on a human face forever.
I just received a book today, and I did get it over the internet. It's called The Water Barons, and it's a project of the Center for Public Integrity. I'm not sure about the website, where they come from, but I have read about 50 pages already, and it's right on regarding research that has been done with the World Bank water policy. It's written by a international consortium of investigative journalists. These are journalists all over the world, from the Philippines, from Asia, from South America, from Europe. And these are journalists that are trying to find out the truth. And they talk about the multinational corporations that's taking over the water in all the countries, not just in the third world countries, but they're talking about the United States also.
And of course, the corporations are coming in here and buying up our local water companies, and then as soon as they do that, they double or triple the prices.
Well, yes, this has happened in Felton up in Santa Cruz Mountains. There's a big German utility company, letters are RWE, and they are about the third biggest in the world. And so they must know something about the water supplies up in Santa Cruz Mountains. They're especially looking at the corporation's three areas in the world, North America and China and Eastern Europe. Those are the ones they are concentrating on now. And as you can see in the back of the book, they have the largest water companies in the world, and actually RWE is from Germany, and it was founded in 1898. They're a real old company, and it's the third largest water services company in the world. Now, that's interesting, services company. The last show I did, Dr. Stan...
Jeannie, I'm going to interrupt you because we're going to have to bring our listeners from up north right back with us. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest in studio is Jeannie Soderman, and we're talking about, of course, these international water companies that are coming in. And what people don't understand, you know, is when you have a negative balance of payments for your foreign purchases, that money has to go someplace. In other words, we spend $500 billion more than we actually make. So all that country ends up in foreign hands. And what do they do with it? Well, they don't want to pay for the walls with it, so they come in and do the patriotic thing. They buy America. And, of course, that's what they're doing. And German corporations and English corporations are coming in, and Japanese corporations and Chinese corporations. And basically, they bought up many of our major grocery chains. They bought up Chrysler has been bought by a German corporation. The Germans are buying up our waterworks here. What people don't understand is that America's for sale, and your heritage and your future for sale. And instead of having our major utilities and other things which are privatizing, and believe me, the privatizing that's going on today, some of it is the worst thing in the world, even though I believe in free enterprise. What they're doing is, this whole idea of privatizing electricity. That was a scam from the very beginning. You can't privatize a utility because there's no competition, and when these major corporations come in, and they have the control of the water, what are you going to do? What are you going to do when they come in and they privatize electricity? Where are you going to get your alternate electricity? What we need is responsible public utilities that are regulated by government, not major corporations that are answerable to no one. Well, of course, the government's going to come. They're answerable to the government. But how many of you really think that Kenneth Lay or any of the real people and responsible for the Enron debacle are going to go to prison? They'll get a few underlings, of course, but the real culprits in all that's going on are going to get off scot-free, especially if they've given large sums of money to our politicians in payment for future services.
Yes, America is for sale, the resources and also the human resources, unfortunately. connected with the World Trade Organization, there's an agreement called the General Agreement on Trade in Services. And that is interesting because now they're negotiating with the European Union. And the European Union wants to all the other countries, there's about 72 they have asked to open up their water markets. And so here we are, trade in services. And if the countries do not open up their water markets, then they'll go into mediation and saying, well, this is not fair. Because of the World Trade Organization, they want to share all the resources throughout the world. So it has to do with money. When I was at the World Forum in New York a couple years ago.
That was the 2000 Millennium Summit?
Yes, and it was the State of the World Forum.
Right.
It went in concert with the UN Millennium Summit. And at a press conference, I asked regarding the resources of the world, would they be shared? And they said on the panel that yes, they would. The resources would be shipped from country to country, depending who needed the resources. Well, we know they're actually being run by who has the money and who can pay for the resources. Now, on water, it was interesting on water banking, because water banking is the same as conjunctive use of combining your groundwater with the surface water. And water banking is in an area where they have an aquifer or a water basin in the wet years, then you can sell your water and bring it to another basin, another part of the United States through pipes. On a dry season, then you store your water. So it's a little bit about money banking. When you have excess money, you put it in the bank. When you need your money, then you take money out of the bank.
Well, it sure sounds great, but in the final analysis, it's simply going to be a means of their controlling you.
Well, it's run by the same people. They stole our hard currency, our silver and gold, Rothschilds, Rockefellers, what I'm looking at, all the research papers. They're all funded by the elites.
Foundation, right.
Yes.
Yeah. And the Ford Foundation, the
yes.
Carnegie Foundation, and the Pew Foundation, the MacArthur Foundation. All the usual suspects are out there. And, of course, there is a ruling elite. I call it the Brotherhood of Darkness. And those of you who haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, need to get that information. You need to understand who really runs the world. And then who runs the people who run the world, because that, of course, is the most carefully kept secret of modern times. Well, anyway, we're going to have to take a quick break here, and when we get back, we'll welcome your calls at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Give us a call right here at Radio Liberty if you have a question or comment about water, the looming world water shortage, and, of course, how it's going to impact on you. Because remember, if they control your water, they control your future. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Jeannie Soderman. We're talking about the world of water shortage, and the whole thing is contrived, but that doesn't really matter. You can convince people of anything. You can convince them there's global warming. You can convince them about the ozone hole. You can convince them that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. There must have been weapons, because after all, the president said there were weapons of mass destruction. Tony Blair said there were weapons of mass destruction, and they wouldn't have lied to us, would they? Well, I've told you many times the weapons of mass destruction were shipped off to Syria many, many months ago. They knew that. But how else could you justify going to war so we could station our troops permanently there? Well, it's the same thing with water. Jeannie, tell us more about this incredible program.
Well, the United States government is getting into water banking, as we described earlier. And you can actually go on the Department of Interior website, and this is www.doi.gov. You have a /water2025. So it's the plan up to 2025. And on the homepage, it says Preventing Crises and Conflict in the West. And you can actually click on a lot of subjects. But the one that's very interesting is called Frequently Asked Questions. Now, the Department of Interior understand that the farmers are very leery of this plan. So one of the questions is, will Water 2025 be used to take water away from agriculture? And the answer, no, this plan seeks to encourage voluntary water transfers through water banks. And there will be willing buyers and willing sellers. Well, here we go. Water banking, and you voluntarily sign on the line. And there will be contracts that they will come up to the people that have private water wells or water user associations. And they will say, you can make a lot of money selling your water. So this is the hook. This is the incentive for people that have private water resources now, that they can make money. It's all about money and enticing the farmers, because we know a lot of farmers are just scraping to get by. It's very, very difficult for agriculture and farming right now, and ranching. And this has been created by the strict regulations coming down by the EPA and government agencies. So this website is extremely interesting to go to.
All right, fine. So they've got the plan that's going through the next 25 years. And, of course, when they sell, so willing sellers and willing buyers, if they cut off your water, you kind of jolly well be a willing buyer because you're not going to have any other source. If you are a farmer and there's no water for your plants or for irrigation, of course you're going to be a willing buyer. They try to give you the idea that this is all voluntary, and none of it's voluntary. It's all planned out by Gorbachev and by Maurice Strong and by Stephen Rockefeller and by the elitists. In fact, Gorbachev even wrote a book, Strong even wrote a book of recently talking about how everything was going to be under local control. They didn't want a centralized control. Everything was to be local. But what he didn't tell you was that all the laws that were passed locally would come down from on top. And then, of course, they would have their agents in every community, the people who are willing to go to all these meetings and get themselves elected onto the commissions and boards. And if that doesn't work, of course, he'll just appoint them by one means or another. And then, of course, these people will pass the laws that will control you and your life. And that's really what it's all about. These people are willing to put their whole of their lives into controlling you. And the question is, what are you willing to do to maintain your freedom? Our telephone number, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. If you have a question or comment, and I wish you could see this pile of material that Jeannie has across the way here. Go ahead, Jeannie.
Well, like you said, the government, the United States government, and even the state government is tied in very tightly with memos of understanding agreements with the federal government. And, of course, the federal government is tied in with all the United Nations treaties. And what they're saying is that they're going to decentralize the water and the government. That is not so. In the World Bank water policy, and you can actually get it on the internet now. That was placed in my hands several years ago, but because the World Bank was really pounded by the environmental organization saying, you're not very transparent, you need to put these policies on the internet. So the World Bank has put this particular water resources management plan on the internet, and that's www.worldbank.org. And what you will be looking for is the Water Resources Management Plan of 1993. That is not an old plan. They are going specifically by that plan now. And so there you can read it. It's about, you can download about 140 pages. And it does say that they're concerned, the World Bank is concerned about having a monopoly on the water. Now, that is so ludicrous, because who's going to have a monopoly is the World Bank. Through the contracts of giving money, financial, for infrastructure and for water projects. And we have a United Nations system chart here under the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations. And of course, who's working with the World Bank is the wonderful United Nations. They are part of the scheme. And under that, it says specialized agencies that work hand in glove with the United Nations. And you will find the World Bank Group. And of course, they have five investment groups under the World Bank. The big one is the International Finance Corporation. They are the investment arm for the World Bank, and they are heavily involved in a lot of water projects throughout the world, Central America, South America, Europe, Asia, and they're in the United States. So here again, if you sign a contract with any of these front organizations for the World Bank, then you're tied in. You've got their money. And actually, in the World Bank water policy, it does say that you have to go by their rules. And it says in page 28, all users of water are to agree to the rules of the game. It's their game. It's the World Bank water policy game. They are going to be controlling the rules on how you use the water, the infrastructure, and how you distribute the water. And so I look at, in our Constitution of the United States, contracts are legal. So are you going to put your name on that line and say, I voluntarily give up my rights? That is so horrendous that they would think that we would sign that line and say, I want to be a slave under the World Bank water policy.
Because the average individual doesn't understand all this. They don't understand the World Bank. Mm-hmm. It is part of this whole scam by which they take something really valuable like paper and they put ink on it and make it essentially worthless. The only reason people accept money is because they think it has real value. It really doesn't. We are, of course, living in a fiat money system. And, of course, this is what they're going to do with this whole water thing. It's a scam as well. But it's a means by which the elite are able to control the people. Who is the World Bank? Well, they are this run by this elite. I'll never forget when, after Robert McNamara left the position of Secretary of Defense, after betraying American boys and sending 58,000 of them to die in Vietnam, where they weren't sent, of course, to win the war. They were sent as a distraction so they could change America and centralize more power over the lives of the people. And then where did Robert McNamara go? Why, of course, he went to work for the World Bank. He was the president of the World Bank for 10 years and totally destroyed Africa after spending $10 billion in Africa. Of course, the living standards of the Africans were far worse after he got done. If you take the organization, the Futurist magazine, you'll find he is on the board of directors along with Marie Strong and our good friend Barbara Marx Hubbard, who, of course, is a Luciferian. One of the richest women in the world. Their emblem used to be, before we started talking about it, a circle made up of three sixes. They changed that logo when we talked about it. But, of course, Robert McNamara and Henry Kissinger are frequent guests at Marie Strong's occult sanctuary, La Baca Grande in Colorado, where all the occultists and the witches and the Satanists meet. And there goes old rich Robert McNamara, former president of the World Bank. So this is the occult influence within the World Bank, and now they want to control our water?
Well, they seem to go, these elitists, from one important management job to another. And in the water arena, I have just read a book written in 1972, and it was funded by the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, and it had to do with land use. And on this advisory task force was a picture. And one of the people around the table with Rockefeller there was William Riley, who used to be head of the EPA, and there was Pete Wilson. In 1972, he was, as I understand, mayor of San Diego, down south, and then he became governor of California. He was the one that signed the Bay Delta Accord that really brought into being the infrastructure how we're going to allot the water throughout the state of California. Pete Wilson. And that didn't even go through the legislature. It was signed by the governor of California with a federal agency. So it was like executive to executive agreement. And that started, it's really like the most important part of water allocation throughout California now, the Bay Delta Accord. We get most of our water from Shasta, the Shasta Mountains, and it comes down through the Central Valley Aqueduct. And it was interesting about in 1992, there was a Central Valley Project Improvement Act, which took away 800,000 acre feet from the farmers of California. And who signed that? Who promoted that? It was President Bush Sr. So it's not only the Democrats that are in this scheme, it is the Republican also. They're working in concert to bring into this one world feudalistic system. So water is super important regarding how are we going to live and what are we going to grow on our land? Are we going to have gardens? And I can see in the future, well, you have too much livestock and you'll have to get rid of some of your cows and your horses and your sheep. But that coincides with the Biodiversity Assessment Report, where it said there was unsustainable items, and one of them were animals that had hoofs, because the hoofs impact the earth on Gaia's skin, and it hurts the water going through the earth down into the water basin. So it coincides with they want to get rid of all our domestic animals also. And this goes into SARS, where in Beijing, I just read an article where they were concerned that the animals, the cats and dogs, were actually spreading SARS. And so they killed cats and dogs in Beijing. And the owners were very, very upset. But I tell you, Dr. Stan, that draws the line when they start killing domestic animals.
Well, you know, Jeannie, there's always been a barrier between animals and human beings. And humans didn't get animal diseases, and animals didn't get human diseases until the era of genetic engineering. There are only a very few diseases we got. We got rabies. We got, of course, equine encephalitis, equine being horse. But most animal diseases we didn't get. Well, when you read my latest newsletter, you'll understand what has been done. We've let the genie out of the bottle. Pandora's out of the box. And, of course, you're absolutely right. SARS has been found in a number of animals, and yet this does not occur naturally in nature. So what happened? Where did SARS really come from? Well, if you really want to know the answer, you'll want to get my latest newsletter. That's the May newsletter, which is in the process right now. Hopefully it will be done in a couple of days. If out there in the listening audience you'd like to get a copy of that, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Ask for the May newsletter, and of course, you'll find it fascinating, and we'll answer the question that Jeannie raised about the killing the dogs and the cats as they're doing in China, because they're infected with this new virus. But where did the new virus come from, and why is it able to cross the species barrier when formerly diseases did not cross the species barrier? So where did the new virus come from? Why does it have the unique qualities that it does? Why are there so many antibiotic-resistant diseases out there? Why is there such an increase in cancer? And those are just a few of the questions that we'll address in our latest newsletter, the information you're not going to get from Barbara Walters, Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, or Rush Limbaugh. Okay, Jeannie, go ahead.
Well, you need to get on the World Bank website. It's so important because you're going to pull down that 1993 water resource management document. They talk about demand management, and when you go into the water district meetings, they talk about demand management. Well, what is that? Well, they actually describe it in the World Bank Water Policy. And what it will mean, there's three features of it. You're going to have price-based incentives. Well, what does that mean? Well, they're going to give you an incentive not to use a lot of water because they're going to price the water way high. They're going to have water rationing.
In other words, basically, they will force you to conserve by the price, just like they're going to force you to conserve on the use of natural gas, like they're going to force you to conserve on the use of gasoline. They will manipulate the price to control you, because that's what it's really all about. Of course, this will not affect the elite, just you common folks.
And the third feature of demand management is water restriction on specific usage, and they will actually look at what you're using your water for. You talk about control, Dr. Stan. This is complete control of human activity, and that's why they're building all these houses. The state is saying, well, you have to build a certain amount of housing units. Say in Santa Cruz, it's a mandate from the state of California. Well, they're building sustainable communities. They're building what they call livable communities. And it's these little tight houses together, two or three stories high, all connected together. And they're building them by the marshes and by the swamps and by the water and by the railroads. And which brings to mind, I was looking at your April newsletter, which I thought was one of the best newsletters I have ever read.
Yes.
And there was one article that you wrote about the Reverend Thomas Malthus, Essay on the Principle of Population.
Isn't that great?
Oh, and he said, and you've got it all footnoted, which I love the newsletters, because being a researcher, you can actually go in back of the newsletter and you can see everything that's documented where you can find it. And Thomas Malthus was talking about, in our towns, we should make the streets narrower, crowd more people into the houses, and court the return of the plague. And we should build our villages near stagnant pools. And we should encourage settlements in all marshy and unwholesome situations. That's what we're doing now. We're creating that. And he wrote this in 1826.
And of course, he was very, very close to Thomas Paine. In fact, many people at that time said that, you know, we should not train the teach the lower classes how to read. You know, this was a terrible thing. And he said, no. He said, I want to teach them how to read so they can read Thomas Paine. Because Thomas Paine hated God. And of course, most people think of him as a great patriot. Well, he was a revolutionary. He's part of this revolutionary movement, the occult, the dark side of the revolutionary movement at the time of the American Revolution. But he was a contemporary of Thomas Malthus. And when you hear the term Malthusian today, you will understand what they mean. Because, of course, as Thomas Malthus said, we certainly want to discourage anyone who wants to stop major plagues. Why? Because there are too many people in the world.
There's a quote by William Z. Foster. He was the national chairman of the Communist Party of USA, and this was in 1932. And this is, quote, the establishment of American Soviet government will involve the confiscation of large landed estates in town and country, and also the whole body of forests, mineral deposits, lakes, rivers, and so on. And this is what's happening now. Through regulations on private property, we are gradually losing our use of our property to create wealth. And it will be the elitists that have total control through the World Bank and their front financial organizations. And they will have control of the resources. Not only water, wood, and mineral deposits and so on, they will have control of human resources. That's stated in the EPA note in one of their seminars, that the humans are to be considered part of the resources.
Now, as David Rockefeller told my friend, Congressman William Dannemeyer, some men are born to rule, but most men are born to be ruled.
We must remember that while we have private property, the regional government, the county government, the planning department, the environmental health services will come by and say, well, I think there's pollution on your land. We'd like to come on your private property and inspect your land and look at your well. Don't let them on your land. This is one of the last defenses that we have to retain private property. What I have seen in red tagging of the private property here in Santa Cruz County, the people have been too nice. They let the county officials come on their land, and the county officials smile and engage them in a conversation, and somehow they find out that there is something they shouldn't be doing with their land, a land use, and that's when they get red tagged. Don't even let them on their land to inspect your well, the quality of the water. Just say, no, thank you. You're not permitted to come on.
All right, fine. Well, I certainly won't disagree with that at all. And, of course, the problem is that there are some very nice people who work for government. It's simply a job, but the people at the very top of this are part of an agenda. These are the people who are in charge of the planning commissions. They have been trained on how to control the common folks and, of course, how to manipulate them and how to lie. And when you begin teaching government officials how to lie, as we've heard from so often people who've gone into the school to complain about something that their child has been taught, and they're told by the teacher, why, nobody else has ever complained about this. You're the first one, and yet you know that a dozen people have been in there before. They teach the teachers how to lie. And if they're teaching the teachers how to lie, then how can teachers teach the students to be honest and truthful? And then we wonder why we have certainly Kenneth Lay and Martha Stewart and other people, cheating on the system. Why we have Governor and then, of course, President Clinton cheating on his wife. We've lost the moral standards, that belief in God and right and wrong that once made America the envy of the world. Or as de Tocqueville said, coming to America and seeing, searching for the cause of our greatness, he said, it wasn't until I went into the pulpits of America and found them flaming with righteousness that I understood the source of America's goodness and greatness. America is great because America is good. But if America ever ceases to be good, America will cease to be great. Ladies and gentlemen, how many of you still think America is really a good nation? We have a lot of good people in it, but I'm talking about the policies of the government that will lie to the people, that will apply hire professional assassins, that to kill their opponents, and those of you who don't believe that, you need to hear my interviews with Chip Tatum, who was hired to by government, who was told to kill Ross Perot and got into trouble because he wouldn't. Colonel Daniel Marvin, who was hired to kill a naval lieutenant who had pictures of the Kennedy assassination. L.D. Brown, who was hired to kill Terry Reid in Mexico, had written a book about President Bush and Governor Bill Clinton. This sort of thing goes on. And where's the outcry from the church? why the church says it's all in God's hands. You don't have to be involved. Well, maybe it's in their God's hands, but I believe God expects us to be standing up for righteousness and doing what's right and demanding that of our government leaders. For God gave us a constitutional republic. The church has lost that republic for us and losing our freedom. Jeannie, we've got about 1 minute or so. Let's wrap up this whole program on water rationing and how they're going to use water to control us.
Well, it's very important that the World Bank wants to terminate, get away with the federal structure of our country, and they want to transfer the water by contract. Don't side the contracts. And this is a quote from Thomas Jefferson. If a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. If we are to guard against ignorance and remain free, it is the responsibility of every American to be informed.
And remember what Jefferson said? God, who gave us life, gave us liberty. But can the liberties of a nation be secure when the conviction has been forgotten that liberty is the a gift of God? And then he went on to say, indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever. And ladies and gentlemen, as we see what's happening in our country, when you read my letters, you realize, of course, that the AIDS virus and the SARS virus and all of these are man-made by secret government projects, and we have the documentation on that. And, of course, over 28 million people have already died of AIDS. And, of course, in the areas where we did a vaccination, why, for instance, in Swaziland, one of the places where Merck Company did their initial vaccination, 85% of the blacks there are infected. Here in San Francisco, where, of course, the homosexuals took the vaccine, why over 80% of them were infected by 1990. These things aren't happening by accident. They're happening by design. And, of course, evil triumphs when good people do nothing. So we ask you, of course, to remember that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and, of course, we depend upon those of you who believe in what we're doing. We hope that you'll give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We hope that many of you will decide you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. If you'd like a free copy of our April newsletter, we'll be glad to send it to you. If you want a copy of our May newsletter, you'll have to wait for that for a few days, but we'd love to hear from you. Please pray for America and pray for Radio Liberty. For our provision and protection, Jeannie Soderman, God bless you. Thank you so much for being with us. And till tomorrow, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming here from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. And Jeannie, thank you so much for the book. Thank you for coming up. And, of course, right now in the studio with us is Brad, upon me, Randy Thomason, and we're going to be talking about the campaign for California families and, of course, what's happening up in Sacramento. Randy, how are you doing tonight?
Hey, Dr. Stan. I'm doing better than last week. Last week was so difficult. It was the midst of the last few minutes of the first half of the legislative football game. Hundreds and hundreds of bills passed in the state assembly, and they came to a crunching halt, at least for half of the session, on Friday, and we're able to pick up the pieces. We had some wins, we had some losses, but we know where we stand.
Well, Chris, you would expect you'd have a lot of losses when the good people of America have allowed the wicked people to take over the control of government, but isn't that always the way it is? The wicked people are willing to organize and put in their time and effort and money, and the good people, they just want to conserve what they have and stay at home and be free, and without realizing that freedom is never free. And, of course, the freedom we have today is because 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, people were willing to put in the time and effort to be involved. And, of course, if we ignore what's going on today, we assure that our children will live in slavery. So, basically, I know that they got through the legislation on the Homosexual Marriage Act. Do you think the governor will veto that? Do you think there's any chance he will?
Well, Dr. Stan, what you say is right in the sense that darkness is the absence of light. And when we look at that, I could be an atheist, I could be a scientist, I could be a Christian theologian. And every time we would understand that darkness is the absence of light, and we have bad government when people who know what is good are not doing their part. They're not the main shapers of government. So with that said, yes, AB 205, the homosexual marriage bill, passed the Democrat-controlled California State Assembly by only one vote. We knew it would be only by one vote, and we were leading the opposition through Campaign for California Families. And it was very, very close. At this point, I think Governor Gray Davis could sign or veto or stop the bill in other ways. He has not staked out a public position on the bill, and it seems clear that the homosexual activists are very nervous what he'll do with it. Even Assemblyman Mark Leno, Democrat of San Francisco, one of the homosexual legislators who's co-authored AB 205, is claiming that the bill gives only a few more rights and responsibilities to domestic partners. He said this on MSNBC when I debated him last Friday. This was on national TV, he said this, and I said, no, that's wrong. AB 205 awards all the rights of married spouses under California law to homosexual couples. Tell the truth. And he didn't want to deal with the truth, Dr. Stan.
Well, of course, but homosexuality is a lie. It's a repudiation of God's rules and God's laws. And, of course, once you come out of the closet, you give yourself over to this political agenda, and you also give yourself over to the dark side. And there's just no way you can violate God's law and flaunt it openly in public and say it's perfectly all right and, of course, still be in his good graces. So they've got a real problem, but the real problem is the churches and the good Christians and the good people of this country that let this terrible thing happen. And this is simply a manifestation of what's going on all across the country. And I fear the wrath of God is going to descend on this state and upon our nation. If there's not a revival, and once again, the people of this country begin to stand for righteousness.
Well, there has to be repentance, Dr. Stan. We have to give up wicked ways. We have to stop worshiping money more than God. And someone might be saying, oh, I don't worship money. What are you talking about? We just try to live a good life, take care of our family, and so forth. Oh, wait a minute. when the average Christian does not want to give money to fighting against wickedness and culture, that's wrong priorities. When the average Christian is afraid to speak in public, is afraid to write a letter to the editor, is afraid to call in to a talk radio program because you're afraid someone might make fun of you, well, then you really don't believe much in what you're thinking because you're afraid of what someone else might say about you, and you care more about their opinion than maybe God's opinion. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, and we're not saying by grace you've been be saved. That's obvious in Scripture. However, but in Scripture you talked about, for by grace you have been saved through faith, not of yourselves, it's a gift of God, that no one can boast. So you are saved by grace by claiming Jesus Christ as your Savior. However, you can't just go to sleep. You can't just say, okay, there's no work to do. Jesus has done all the work for me. No, you have to keep reading. Ephesians 2:10 says, for we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which he has prepared beforehand for us to walk in. So the life that pleases God is a life of faith that does good for him, that loves God, love your neighbor, and that involves actions and deeds of faith, as we are told in the book of James. So, Dr. Stan, there is work to do. I'd like to give a phone number for Governor Gray Davis.
You go right ahead.
I know our time is short, but we have to get involved now, and I think there's a chance, a 50-50 chance, actually, that this bill could be stopped, because as the recall petitions are being gathered, the recall of Gray Davis, I believe it's going to be on the ballot, and this governor is said to be, quote, out of his mind by people who are close to him and who have leaked this to the media. If this gets on his desk, AB 205, and the recall signatures have been gathered, I think the governor is going to gulp really big and think, uh-oh, am I really going to go against 61.4% of the voters of California who wanted marriage to stay between a man and a woman? So load him up with phone calls as those petition signatures are still being gathered. Governor Gray Davis's phone number is 916-445-2841, 916-445-2841. Tell Governor Davis's message takers, or if you have to leave a recording, do that. Tell him AB 205 awards spousal rights to homosexuals and rejects the people's vote on marriage. If you reject the people's vote, the people will reject you. Tell them to veto or oppose AB 205.
All right, fine. What's happening with the budget there?
Well, we got about 5 days till the constitutional deadline for it to pass, and of course they're going to miss their deadline, we know that. But the Democrats want to raise your taxes. The Republicans are actually united, Dr. Stan, in saying no new taxes or fees. So it's going to be a standoff, and it's likely to happen that the budget writers, the Democrat majority, are going to try to paper over the debt and push the debt into future years and make it even worse.
Well, of course, you know, our credit status is beginning to decompensate here in California, which means, of course, if you want to go out and borrow money, it's going to cost you more and more because people don't have the confidence in California they used to. And we're still losing so many jobs simply because of the policies they have here, the workman's compensation, the government regulations, the environmental regulations, and then, of course, the price of electricity, and, of course, the anti-business climate of the Wilson administration. So, you know, as more and more industry moves elsewhere, offshore or into other states, that's going to cut down, of course, on the state's income as well. Certainly, when April 15th rolled around, they didn't have anywhere near as much money as they hoped, did they?
No, they didn't. And it keeps compounding. It keeps getting worse. In fact, you know, in July, the state is officially going to be out of money. And so that's why the Democrats and the unions that are supporting big government are pushing for higher taxes. In fact, the school unions are spending $1 million in a lobbying campaign to say raise the sales tax. You see, bad leaders aren't for the people. They're just for themselves, and they want to feather their own nest, and they want to take more and more of your money in order to make themselves feel good and be what they want to be, which is powerful. And we need to cut government down to size. It's gotten too powerful. We need to take away what government has done to us. We need to take back some of our taxpayer money. Let's have a tax cut in California, not a tax hike, but at least maybe if we can call it a status quo and say no tax cut, no tax hike, cut the spending, though, in a deficit situation, that'd be a better world. In any case, Governor Davis has shown himself not to be the leader he claims to be.
And, of course, are the Republicans hanging together there and opposing the tax hike?
You know, except for a few stragglers, you talked about some of the Republicans who caved in the past. There was one, Keith Richmond, an assemblyman of Simi Valley. He's one of the most liberal Republicans in the state assembly. He was thinking of doing a deal with the Democrats, but even now he says he thinks that the budget deadline will be missed. You see, while the Republicans don't always agree on everything, I think one thing they're agreeing on is no new taxes now. While they care more about protecting taxes or protecting us from tax hikes than perhaps the fighting the homosexual agenda effectively. Jim Brulte, the state Senate Republican leader, actually held a closed-door meeting with all the Republican legislators and essentially said, you vote for a tax hike and I'll go campaign against you in your district. And at least that was a principle on taxes, and I think that's going to mean that the debate will continue through the summer, and it will be further evidence as we go toward the final collection of signatures for the Davis recall that Gray Davis is not leading. He is not presenting a plan that will get the votes for a balanced budget, and it's just going to draw more attention to the governor who can't govern.
All right, fine. Let's get your website out, your telephone number, and then we'll let you go.
Dr. Stan, we'd love to have the listeners visit our website. SaveCalifornia.com is the home of Campaign for California Families. Visit SaveCalifornia.com today, and you can send powerful email messages to all the state legislators thanking them or telling them how disappointed you are for their vote on AB 205. We're keeping the battle going. It's where you can also sign up for free email updates at SaveCalifornia.com.
And, of course, can they get a copy of the recall petition, Davis recall petition, if they want to?
Yes, you can. You can download it right there at SaveCalifornia.com. Of course, you have to be a California registered voter to sign it, and you can only sign it once. But if you haven't signed it, or you know a Californian who hasn't, go to SaveCalifornia.com, download the petition, get it signed, and get it back in our hands.
All right, fine. Thanks very much, Randy. God bless you. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you, Dr. Sam.
Bye-bye. Okay, let's go. I bet this is Brad Dacus. Hi, Brad. How are you doing?
Doing great, Dr. Stanley.
Well, tell us what's happening. Now, Brad Dacus, for those of you who don't know, is from the Pacific Justice Institute, and, of course, he's on the front lines of the legal battle that is being waged against Christians and Christian organizations here in California. So what's the latest status? Are we winning or are we losing?
This is a victory, and we're really excited about this one. As you know, about a year ago, Delaine Easton, superintendent of public instruction, she came out and announced, just unilaterally announced, that homeschooling was illegal. Unless you were a credentialed teacher as a parent, you were violating the law and if you were homeschooling. And, of course, it just sent shockwaves among the homeschoolers and others in California. And then what happened is we actually had a case in Santa Fe County and San Mateo County where homeschoolers were actually threatened to have their children taken from them and put in foster homes unless they stopped homeschooling and put their kids in public schools. And we intervened on both of those, and I'm pleased to announce that we were successful to prevail on both of those. But still, there's a lot of fear. Well, the good news is earlier this year, we sent a very clear, solid legal demand letter to the California Department of Education and stating that homeschooling is legal. Well, the new state superintendent of public instruction, who replaced Elaine Easton, has now announced that he agrees basically with it and has reversed their former policy.
Now, how did it happen that Elaine Easton was replaced? Did Governor Davis replace her?
She was term limited out, and it was an elected elected position. So since she was term limited out, then this other gentleman took her place.
Okay, fine. Did he win the election then?
Yeah, he did, and he actually had the support of the teachers union. He was their candidate, and yet this is why it makes it so surprising, because I think what he's done is he's looked at the big picture and realized that homeschoolers are gaining in strength, political strength, and in reputation, and that if he wants to maintain any kind of a centrist position, he has to, at the very least, rescind that policy stating that all homeschoolers are illegal, are breaking the law. So that was a good move, and now, of course, it's now up to local school districts. That's what he said. You know, they say it's up to local school districts to decide whether there's truancy or whether or not a kid actually is getting an education at home. And so we now have all these school districts we're going to have to continue watching to make sure they don't go after innocent homeschoolers.
All right, fine. Well, Brad, I think that's really great. Do you want to get out your website and your telephone number?
Oh, you bet. Our website is pacificjustice.org. That's pacificjustice.org. And our telephone number, if anyone needs any assistance or would like us to arrange a speaker for their church or event, they can contact us at 888-305-9129. That's 888-305-9129.
Well, God bless you. Thanks very much for everything you do. We'll look forward to talking to you next week.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. That's Brad Dacus. And certainly both he and Randy are two of the real movers and shakers in this state. And we put them on because we think that they have a very important message. And we hope that many of you out there will want to support them. Certainly all the ministries need support. A lot of them are really hurting now, and including Radio Liberty to an extent. But I certainly want to tell you that these people, Brad and Randy, deserve your support. And of course, they're serving a purpose. They are doing some things that nobody else is doing. And of course, the ability to have free legal service for, you know, if you are a case that qualifies under their rules of engagement, as it were, is well worthwhile. And of course, certainly Randy up there in Sacramento, lobbying for the righteousness in the situation in Sacramento, where of course the forces of evil reign supreme. And of course, those of you who've listened to my ministry and listened to me talk, realize that from the very inception of America, why of course there was the strong Christian influence here, but there was also the influence of evil. And shortly after the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth, why, of course, a group of Rosicrucians were sent over by Francis Bacon to fulfill the dream of establishing here in the United States the New Atlantis that had been lost. And, of course, that was the title of Francis Bacon's book, The New Atlantis. Francis Bacon was a Rosicrucian. This was part of this world occult movement, the Rosicrucians, which date back to the 1400s, but of course they're simply a continuation of the mystery religions. Basically, of course, we have the dark forces, they're working here, and all we can do is hope and pray that we're going to be able to have people understand that we are truly involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. So we'll be back here in just a moment. Right now, we're having a little difficulty getting our next guest, and it may be this is even going to be open lines. I'm just going to make sure that our call screener has the right telephone number, and if he does, then we'll have to just wait for you to give us a call. So I'll ask Herman to come in here. I'll give him the telephone number, and then we'll just go from there. But we're going to have a little music, and then I'll be right back here in just a moment. And, of course, if our guest isn't there, why, you're going to have to be the guest and to keep the program going. So we'll be with you in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, Dr. Stan, it looks like we're not going to have our guest with us tonight. We'd hoped to have Mr. Richardson talking about the secrets of the Quran. But since he's not there, why, it's just going to be you and me. So if you have a call, a question, give us a call here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you'd like to talk about what Jeannie was talking about last hour. If not, why, you're going to have to talk about what I would like to talk about. And that is the most incredible, incredible war of all time. Now, as we pointed out in the past, the Korean War really wasn't a war at all. The Korean War was a military exercise that ended up with the loss of 42,000 American boys, and about 8,000 of those were abandoned so that the Koreans and the Communists and the Chinese could experiment on them, and they were abandoned by our government. And then, of course, the Vietnam War really wasn't a war. We were never allowed to win. The rules of engagement were designed to ensure that we would never be allowed to win, and we were never allowed to attack the enemy. All we could do was, of course, attack his outposts, but never go after Hanoi, never, of course, bomb the major sites in Haiphong, the harbor, the ships, block the harbor, sink a ship in the mouth of the harbor, mine the harbor, bomb the rail yards, bomb the dikes, bomb the hydroelectric plants, bomb any of the important targets in North Vietnam. It was all a phony war. Well, now, let's then fast forward to the recent war with Iraq. And of course, really what's so amazing about this war is that the military generals who spent all their life studying military strategy said, we need another 100,000 men to really be able to fight this battle effectively, you know, because we're going to meet resistance and we want to be able to have just a massive force to be able, of course, to be victorious. And Donald Rumsfeld, with no military experience at all, although he had served as Secretary of Defense in a previous administration, said, no, all you generals who spent all your life studying military strategy, you don't know what's going to happen. I do. And we don't need all those men. We're simply going to push right through into Baghdad and, of course, take Iraq, capture Iraq. Now, what's really so incredible about this is that Donald Rumsfeld was entirely right. The military generals who spent all their life studying military strategy were all wrong. Now, how could that be true? Is Donald Rumsfeld that much smarter than our military, or did he know something that the military leaders didn't know? And my friend Dennis Cuddy had, in his book, which he wrote called A Cover-Up, and you really want to get a copy of it. It's his latest book. It has many, many wonderful quotations in it, but he commented that if this was going to be a real war, there are certain things that would happen. First of all, America would have a large number of casualties. If this was a real war, why Saddam Hussein, if he had chemical and biological weapons, would have used those weapons to inflict casualties on our people. He would, of course, put to fire all of the oil wells in southern Iraq and every oil well he possibly could have set on fire, simply to have the smoke and have we'd have to go in and, of course, put those oil wells out. He certainly would have blown up the bridges across the Euphrates. We had to get across those bridges. He would have taken out the roads, and people say, "Well, of course, our tanks should go over the open sand," and that's absolutely true. But of course, the trucks would have difficulty, especially if you had the area mined. But they didn't mine the area. They didn't blow up the roads. They didn't blow up the bridges. And then, of course, they didn't blow up any or destroy any of the airports there that could have been used, you know, to prevent us from landing planes and bringing in supplies. And, of course, we had a 300-mile supply line going through potentially hostile territory, only there wasn't any hostile territory. The Iraqi army was told to surrender and simply to pull back. Oh, there were a few Iraqis who didn't know what it was all about, and they were willing to fight to the death for their country, but unfortunately they didn't understand that this was not a real war. Now, of course, the Iraqis had many Sukhoi missiles that could have wrecked a great deal of havoc. They fired one of them. Why were they saving the silkworm missiles? Were they saving it for the next war? They had surface-to-air missiles that certainly couldn't have taken out our jets, but they could have taken out our helicopters. And yet the only helicopter we lost was a helicopter that was shot down by somebody with an automatic rifle. Now, why wouldn't they use the weapons that they had to defend the motherland and defend the dictator, the wicked Saddam Hussein? What's wrong with this picture? They had over 100 fighter planes. Now, admittedly, they would have not been very effective against our planes, but why didn't they use them anyway? I mean, after all, they're fighting for the very survival of Iraq and the survival of the corrupt regime of the wicked Saddam Hussein. So why didn't they put those planes up in the air? Were they saving the planes for the next Iraqi war? I mean, what's wrong with the picture? They had helicopters that they could have used. So why didn't they use any of the helicopters, to attack our forces and then, set them down? Or, they could have used their planes, but they didn't do any of the things. And you have to understand that the military units, the Republican Guard, loyal to the president, Saddam Hussein, were ready to fight to the death. And they were simply told to retreat north of the city, and when they got there, they were told to take off their uniforms and go home. Now, what was this really all about, and where is Saddam Hussein? Well, you have to really go into the background of the history of this era and this area. And most Americans really don't know their history. They don't understand what goes on behind the scenes. And because they don't know, they are incapable of understanding what goes on. There's a wonderful book. It's called Unholy Babylon. In fact, I've read about the book and one of the new articles off the internet somebody has sent me, and I thought it was such a fascinating book. I tried to get a copy of it, and it was out of print, and I thought, well, let me just go out and look in my library. For those of you who don't know, we have probably 20,000 or 30,000 books in the library, somewhere well over 20,000, I'm sure. And, of course, there in my library was a copy of Unholy Babylon. In fact, there were two copies. So, you know, I got it out and was reading it. And, of course, it was talking about back in 1950 when Saddam Hussein was part of an assassination unit that was employed by the American Central Intelligence Agency. And then during the 1960s, everybody thought Saddam Hussein was hired by and employed by the Central Intelligence Agency. But of course, members of the Ba'ath Party said, oh no, he wasn't. And any of you would like the pages out of this book, written well over a decade ago, about Saddam Hussein's relationship with the Central Intelligence Agency, would be glad to get those for you. And you have to understand that Saddam had worked with the Central Intelligence Agency certainly as far back as the late 1950s. And then, of course, he came to power. The Ba'ath Party took power in 1969 with our help. And then, of course, Saddam has seized power in 1979. About the same time we were toppling the Shah of Iran to bring the Ayatollah Khomeini to power. About the same time we were fomenting the war in Afghanistan by sending money to the Mujahideen to topple the Soviet regime there so the Soviets would invade, so we could have a war, so we could bring in the Muslim warriors throughout the world and indoctrinate them in the radical Islamic beliefs, and that's exactly what we did. We promoted the radical Islam, the importance of killing the infidels, who at that time, of course, were the Soviets, and how wonderful it was to die for Allah, and the Wahhabi religion was fomented and pursued and encouraged in Afghanistan by our government. In fact, at that time, during those years of the Afghan War, the United States Agency for International Development spent $56 million, that's $56 million, on textbooks to indoctrinate the youth of Afghanistan, the young men, about the glories of dying for Allah, of fighting to the death. They taught them all about military tactics, about how, you know, if you did, well, arithmetic was taught. I know two rifles, three landmines, and four bullets is how many weapons. Why would you do something like that? We have the articles out of the Washington Post, goes into great detail. I don't think they even understood the significance of what they were pointing out. And of course, they said that, you know, some people asked the USAID why they were fomenting, why they were promoting religion, because, of course, for the separation of church and state, why, you know, why would you encourage this radical Islamic belief, telling people how wonderful it was to die and to commit suicide for Allah? And, of course, the response was, well, of course, you know, if we didn't have that in there, well, they wouldn't have used the textbook. We had to have something that was culturally appropriate. Well, gee, why couldn't we talk about Christmas in a Christian textbook in a Christian nation like America? Oh, we couldn't do that. There's a wall of separation between church and state. The American government actively encouraged this whole radical Islamic movement. And, of course, for those of you who have not read the book, Dollars for Terror, written by a Swiss journalist back in 1999, and he points out that this whole radical Islamic terrorist movement was funded by the Saudis, our good friends in Saudi Arabia, but certainly by our good friends over in Pakistan, and Pakistani intelligence, and of course by the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, Murder Incorporated. We're going to be right back here. Welcome your calls at Radio Liberty at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and of course, this is the time if you'd like to give us a call. Our telephone number is 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. If you have a question, a comment, you agree or disagree. And of course, in lieu of a regularly scheduled guest, we're just going into the background of what's happening in the Middle East. And pointing out that if you read books like Unholy Wars by John Cooley, who was the foreign correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and this book is also written in 1999, he goes into the background of how we funded Osama bin Laden during the Afghan War. And he was working very closely with the Central Intelligence Agency. And then when the war ended in 1988, he organized Al-Qaeda, and we helped to finance that. Al-Qaeda, of course, was to be these Muslim warriors. We called them Mujahideen. They were referred to as the Afghans, and they weren't Afghanistani at all. Muslims, they were Muslims throughout the world who went to Afghanistan. They were warriors who would come there and then learned the values of fighting for Allah. And, of course, that's the great tragedy of what happened. And, of course, what happened was that we created the best enemy American money could buy. If you read John Cooley's book, he will talk to you and explain to you that that they actually financed America, financed the Taliban. Now, the difficulty that we have as far as this is concerned is the fact that the Taliban then, of course, was an extremist group. The Taliban certainly oppressed women, but we financed the Taliban, and we continued financing them all the way up until 2000. We'll be back here in just a moment with, hopefully, with some more information for you. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're going to see if we can fax our regularly scheduled guest. Otherwise, it's just going to be you and me, unless you'd like to give us a call at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Those of you who remember the president's speech on the 20th of September, 2001, and we actually have copies of that speech, in which he talked about how he was the United States was the major source of financial aid to Afghanistan at the time. And I've forgotten how many million dollars we were giving Afghanistan in the year 2001. Now, when we were the major source of funding for Afghanistan, in essence, we were financing the Taliban because they controlled all of that country other than, of course, the northernmost section, which was under the control of the Northern Alliance. And they were the drug growers at the time. The Taliban, of course, it shut down the growth of heroin at the time, of opium poppies. And, of course, once we destroyed the Taliban, brought in the Northern Alliance, which is pro-communist, has always been pro-communist, financed by the Russians. Why, of course, then, of course, the poppies begin to grow again. And right now, of course, the Northern Alliance is really in control. We have Karzai, former employee of UNICAL, who we appointed as the dictator of the country, but of course the real force, the military force in the country, besides the warlords, the only centralized authority, comes from the Northern Alliance, and it is pro-communist. So what we have done after going to war in the 1980s to drive the communists out, now we put the communists right back in power. In fact, we use the Northern Alliance and financed the Northern Alliance all against the war, against the Taliban. And what was this really all about? Well, it really wasn't about capturing Osama bin Laden. Why do I say that? Why? Because we have articles out of the Washington Times quoting high government officials who said, our policy is not to get Osama bin Laden first. Our policy is Osama bin Laden last, because after all, if we captured Osama bin Laden, how would we be able to justify continuing the war? And I think that's a good question. So they never really tried to catch Osama bin Laden, and our good friend Joel Skousen has actually commented that he knows of at least three occasions where, since the end of the Afghan War, and of course, as you know, the Afghan War is still going on, but at least since we declared victory, and I guess that's when we have to say the war ended, why, at least on three different occasions, why people have come from Pakistan, gone to Washington, D.C., to the Defense Department, to tell Donald Rumsfeld and the military exactly where Osama bin Laden is hiding, and you know they don't want to know where he is. Can you imagine that? To think that possibly we're really not interested in getting Osama bin Laden? Do you think that we need them out there so we'll have somebody to hate and fear and so we can convince the American people that there's really still a threat from Islamic terrorism and so the American people will continue to agree to ever more government control over our lives? Of course, always in the name of fighting Islamic terrorism. And for those of you who really believe that we are involved in a war with Islamic terrorism, let me ask you a question. How many terrorist attacks have there been on America since the September 11th, 2001 attack almost 2 years ago? How many major terrorist attacks have there been on the United States in the intervening years? Well, there was only one that we can think of, and of course that was the attack with the anthrax. But all of the evidence suggests that that really wasn't a real attack. Certainly Dick Cheney knew the attack was coming. He knew the attack was coming because he had started himself and his family on Cipro, which is specifically for drug of choice for anthrax, on the very night of September 11th. If he knew the attack was coming or suspected it was coming, why, he certainly should have told the American people, wouldn't you think? In fact, isn't it a crime if you know a crime is about to occur and you don't report it? Aren't you guilty of the crime as much as anybody? Well, right now we have this on the air, Mr. Richardson, who's written a fascinating book called The Secrets of the Quran. How are you tonight?
I'm fine. Thank you for the invitation to be on your program.
Well, we've been trying frantically to get you for half an hour. I don't know what happened there.
Well, I'm sorry about that. It was a miscommunication.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, of course, now you've actually lived in Indonesia for many years among the Muslims.
Yes, 15 years. And initially, we were exclusively with tribal people. But then that part of New Guinea became a province of Indonesia. And so my wife Carol and I found ourselves interacting with Muslims increasingly. And after that, I traveled to other predominantly Muslim nations, including Saudi Arabia, Malaysia, and began to study Islam.
All right, fine. Well, what is your impression now? Of course, you were a Christian missionary. And, of course, once you were forced into working with the Muslims, what is their attitude towards Christians and Christian missionaries?
Well, in the days that we were in Indonesia, which was back in the 60s and early 70s, the Muslims there were moderate, and we had no problems with them. But then a change began to happen because people from Saudi Arabia, influenced by what they now recognize was a special brand, a warmongering brand of Islam called Wahhabism, began to influence Indonesian Muslims, began to open schools teaching radicalism, and gradually, year by year, we saw a change that was menacing. Finally, Christians began to find their churches were being burned. They were being fired from their jobs and told, come back a Muslim and you'll be rehired.
Oh, curious, what year was this? What time period was this?
This was in the late 1970s. In the mid to late 1970s.
All right, fine. So this was maybe 1965, 66, 67, or later than that?
Yes. Well, we arrived there in 62. So from 62 on into the 70s, we began to notice that change.
All right, fine. So anyway, of course, it's just Saudi Arabian influence, of course, that really using this massive amount of money that they had to push this radical form of Islam, not only in Indonesia, but throughout the Muslim world, and even here in the United States and in Great Britain and throughout Europe. And they've spent literally tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars right here in the United States pushing this radical form of Islam with the full cooperation of our government. And, of course, that is what's so unconscionable.
That's unfortunate. In some ways, our government has been naive about Islam. I think it is beginning to awaken, but there's still a dangerous level of naivete there. And it's that naivete that I wrote Secrets of the Quran to try to dispel.
All right, fine. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the questions you've raised. What's the redemptive analogy, and what does it have to do with Muslims? What is redemptive analogy?
Well, a redemptive analogy is a name that I gave back in the 1970s to things in human cultures that I believe God has ordained to serve as eye-openers for redemptive truth, heart-openers. And the way I discovered this principle was in my own experience working in the midst of one of the tribes of the Indonesian part of New Guinea, a tribe of headhunter cannibals called the Sawi. I found out when I told them the story of Judas betraying Jesus to death, they thought Judas was the hero. They were a tribe that honored treachery as a virtue. And so Jesus was the dupe to be laughed at. But everything changed when I discovered that their way of making peace required a father in one of two warring villages to give a demonstration of goodwill, of sincerity that was beyond suspicion. And what did he have to do? He had to make an incredible sacrifice, taking one of his own sons and giving that son as a tarotin, that means as a peace child, to a father in the enemy village. And I actually saw a father do that. And amazingly, he did something that no other Sawi father had ever done in living memory. He gave not one of several children, as was usually the case. He gave an only child. And I saw this happen, and I thought, what is this? A father is giving a son, his only son at that, to his enemies for the purpose of reconciliation. There's something very familiar about this. And sure enough, it was an analogy of God's redemptive plan, giving his son as the once-for-all perfect peace child for mankind. So with that analogy, I was able to explain the gospel to the Sawi in such a way that, lo and behold, when I explained that Jesus was a peace child, they said, but do you mean to tell us that this man named Judas was betraying a peace child? And I said, yes. They said, oh, if you had told us that, no way would we have acclaimed him as a hero. To betray a peace child is the most heinous thing anyone could do. So Judas's rating slipped, and Jesus was unveiled as the perfect personal fulfiller of their own uniquely Sawi peace child custom. And I've found ever so many other examples in cultures around the world. For example, in the ancient writing system of the Chinese, the word that means righteous is written with two little pictures, one above the other. The other upper picture has to be a little picture of a lamb. And underneath it, another little picture that means first person singular pronoun. So when the Chinese write the word that means righteous, they're actually writing the lamb over me, righteous. So these are two examples of redemptive analogies, but when it comes to Islam, there's something very different, because whichever biblical truth you would use a redemptive analogy to lead a Muslim friend to acknowledge, lo and behold, when you bring him to that beautiful truth in the scriptures, you find out that Muhammad has already been there. In the Quran, he has changed the definition, changed the concept of this thing. So it's not such an easy thing to use a redemptive analogy approach with Muslims. It's as if somehow someone knew that redemptive analogies were there to serve God's purpose in opening the eyes of people for redemption, and Islam was designed to frustrate that use of redemptive analogies, to make it not work, so that it would be more difficult to bring people out of the darkness into the light.
Well, you've written a book called Eternity in Their Hearts. Is that the sort of the story that you're telling of these various people? All of them at least have some knowledge of the Christian message, even though they've never heard it?
Yes. It's not so much that they have knowledge of the Christian message, but they have customs that somehow anticipate the Christian message. They themselves would not say, well, this is Christian. But these are things that lend themselves marvelously to use like messengers of the gospel as eye-openers. And so when it comes to Islam, you feel like an attorney in a courtroom interrogating a witness and finding he has no choice but to say to the judge, Your Honor, I request permission to treat this witness as hostile. Because Muhammad knew certain things about Scripture, and he denied them. For example, in the New Testament, we find that Jesus is the Passover lamb who died for the sin of the world. Well, Muhammad denied that Jesus died on the cross. There was no crucifixion. Even in the Old Testament, when he told the story of the Exodus, which, by the way, he tells 27 times in the first 89 chapters of the Quran, that's the same story narrated once in every 3.3 chapters, he left out the Passover. 27 tellings of the Exodus story, and the Passover is omitted. Well, this is an example of how Muhammad, in downloading things from the Old Testament into the Quran, somehow he let a virus get into the software, and things got changed. When he told the story of Gideon selecting his smaller number of soldiers out of a larger number, lo and behold, Muhammad made a little mistake. He gave the credit for that story to King Saul. Oh, and he has, in four of the tellings of the Exodus story, he has Haman from the book of Esther interacting with Pharaoh in Egypt in the days of Moses to build a tower of bricks up to heaven. So he really got Old Testament stories confused, and in rather laughable ways, but it's very serious when the Passover is omitted from the Old Testament and when the sacrifice of Jesus Christ in the New Testament is denied. So that's why I say that the Islam is inherently antagonistic to the idea of an atonement whereby God can justly forgive the guilty without compromising his own holy nature in the process. So we need to show, I think it's very necessary to help Muslims to see the evidence that Muhammad was not a holy prophet.
You know, I think it's so interesting, your point about the Passover, and I don't think many people may not have thought this thing through, but what was the Passover all about? Why, it was the blood of the lamb that protected the Jewish family from the angel of death that was going around and killing the firstborn. And this was a lamb that was sacrificed, so the blood then could be the protection for the Jews. That was the Passover, and of course, this angel of death or force of death passed over those Jewish homes. And so this was, of course, a foreshadowing of this story of Christ's crucifixion. That's amazing. I did not realize, of course, that Muhammad had done that. But, of course, you've had the opportunity to study the Quran and, of course, to see how it then has conditioned the minds of the Muslims against the Christian message.
Yes. Then, besides analyzing, giving a real in-depth analysis of the content of the Quran, I do other things, too. I describe radical Muslim strategies for world domination. Many people think, oh, Islam is just another religion. It's not a political force. Actually, it is a political force. There are five verses in the Quran in which Muhammad urges Muslims to fight, using terms like jihad, holy war, until, and I quote, until Islam is the only religion, and until Islam, it just dominates the earth. And so now there are millions of moderate Muslims who don't take those verses seriously. And yet, if anyone asks them, do you believe that every verse in the Quran is inspired by God, they'll say yes. And radical Muslims are able to take advantage of their verbal assent to everything that's in the Quran to try to radicalize them. So they'll say, are you sure you believe these verses? What about this one that says, chop off the heads of infidels? Are you willing to do that if Allah would require you to? And so right now, there are hundreds of radical Muslim websites on the Internet, which is an evidence that radical Muslims, supported by the oil money that we talked about in Saudi Arabia, are trying to zealously radicalize the nominal Muslims who, thank God, are still the majority. But as more and more moderate Muslims are radicalized by the teaching, the inducement of radical teaching from the Quran, we're going to have an increasing problem. and Islam has found ways to invade our academic campuses by offering money to build Islamic study centers, with the condition, of course, that the professors have to be appointed by those who pay for the construction of the buildings. They will say, if we're going to pay for this Department of Islamic Studies on your campus, we want to be sure that Islam is equitably represented in it, so you have to let us provide the professors, which they do, and they are qualified PhDs, but they're also trained as Muslim propagandists who know how to praise Islam in the classroom and make denigrating remarks about Christianity, and also in public television, right, PBS. We've seen in the last year two or three successive programs. One was called Islam Empire of Faith, which are propaganda for Islam, misrepresenting many things in the Quran, many things in the life of Muhammad. And it's partly funded by American tax dollars. Radical Muslims are working zealously in our prisons. And of course, everyone can say, well, they're going to teach violent men to be good citizens. And perhaps some of them have that effect. But Charles Colson, who, has the Christian prison ministry, is concerned, wondering, there's so much pressure now in prisons for convicts, inmates, to convert to Islam. More and more convicts in prisons are coming to Christian chaplains saying, "Chaplain, you don't know how much pressure there is for me to convert to Islam, and I don't want to, but what am I going to do?" And why are they so interested to convert people in prisons to Islam? Chuck Colson has expressed the concern that they might say to these convicts who become Muslims, "Before you used violence for your own greed, killing somebody in a 7-Eleven to steal a few dollars, but the day will come when you can be violent for Allah's purpose, because Allah ordains holy war, jihad, and you will need to be one of his soldiers." And so there are other things that are happening. Already there is a splendid Muslim mosque standing in every city of South America. Well, how many Americans know that Islam is on the move to Islamicize our neighbors to the south? And wherever there's a mosque, in time, there's a Muslim elementary and high school with a big sign, canvas sign hanging the outside of the wall saying to Catholics in South America, "Come see what Islam can do for you and your family." And so some naive Roman Catholic parents, just to save money getting a cheaper education for their children, will send them to Muslim schools, saying, of course, "Now remember, you're a Catholic, you're not a Muslim, and when they talk about Islam, don't listen." But the parents have no idea how subtle, how skilled the Muslim teachers in the school will be in persuading their children that they should indeed be Muslim.
Well, now, what about the influence here in the United States and the mosques here in this country?
Yes, we're hearing more and more reports of some mosques, not all by any means, where the mullahs, that's the Muslim equivalent of a pastor, is preaching fiery rhetoric, anti-American things, blaming America for this and blaming the Jews for that, blaming Christians for lots of things. And the FBI has begun to be aware of this and has begun to try to infiltrate to see what is being taught. Are people being urged to prepare for violence? Not right now. Not that they would be ready to do violent things right now, unless, of course, it was a 9-11 kind of a terrorist act. So there is real concern, because there are, listen to this number, 109 war verses in the Quran. A war verse is a verse that Muhammad dictated to his scribes 1,400 years ago, urging his followers to do things like chop off the heads of infidels. He recommends torture, chop off their fingertips. Other verses say, do not make friends of them. Another verse says, ambush them. And I counted them. The Muslims are constantly telling us in the media, yes, there are war verses, but only 5 or 6, and they're all about Muslims defending themselves when they're attacked. Well, I did an in-depth analysis and counted the war verses. I found 109, which means that 1 out of every 55 verses in the Quran is a war verse, and only 5 or 6 are about self-defense. In all the others, it is the Muslims who are urged by their prophet, Muhammad, to be the aggressors, to be warmongers, to hunt down, ambush, kill, slay non-Muslims. Now,
Don't they even in many instances actually kill other Muslims who won't convert to their more radical form of Islam?
Here's one of the things that millions of people do not know about Islam, that there's something in the Quran, there's a principle called abrogation, and what that means is that if you have a verse in chapter 2, like the one that says, there is no compulsion in religion, well, you know, Muslim apologists will quote that verse again and again as an evidence that Islam is a religion of peace. The problem is that Muhammad, in dictating the 6,000 verses that eventually became the Quran, frequently got complaints from people that a later verse contradicted an earlier one. And so he got tired of hearing this complaint, and tired of trying to make sure that everything he said later was consistent with what he'd said before. So he just came up one day with this statement, quoting God as saying, can I not give you a good verse today and a better one later? And that's the basis of a Muslim doctrine called abrogation, which means whenever one verse in the Quran is contradicted by another verse, the one that was revealed last overrules the one that was given first.
Well, of course, my understanding is that many of the earlier verses were more peaceful and many of the later verses were
warlike. Yes, so that's why the war verses tend to abrogate, annul, overrule the peaceful sounding verses. So you see, if a translation of the Quran was honestly given, every verse that Muslim scholars know has been abrogated by a later verse would have to have a little footnote, and the references of all the verses that abrogate this particular verse would be given, so that we would know, oh, this is a verse that is no longer to be taken seriously because it's an abrogated verse. But no, they don't have a translation that tells you that. So you're left guessing, and how are we to know which one was given later? You know, sometimes you can guess. But this principle of abrogation is something that Muhammad invented to cover his bases and to protect himself from the charge that he was contradicting himself.
Well, Don, we're out of time. I do want to get you back on our other programs. You have so much to say and a fascinating, fascinating background. So I hope I can call on you later to be on some of the other programs. May I?
Yes. You certainly can, and thank you for this evening call.
And how can people get your book?
Well, if there's a Christian bookstore anywhere near, go and get it.
Okay, it's Secrets of the Quran. We're out of time. God bless you. Good night.
Thank you.
And this is Dr. Stan. Pray for America. Until tomorrow night, may the Lord be with you.